Can you outline what you see as being the second stage of feminism?
Well, the women's movement was the first stage, and the thrust of the women's movement was break through the feminine mystique, which defined us solely in terms of our role in the family as wife, mother, housewife, server of physical needs, husband, children, home, and denied our need and our possibility and our ability and our yearning to move in a society as persons in our own right. And the first stage, having asserted our personhood of women, then concentrated on breaking through the barriers of sex discrimination that kept women from having our own voice and working to our full ability in every field and profession that outside the home that was defined as man's world. And we spent about 15 years with the laws, the class action suits, the marches, breaking through the barriers of sex discrimination and uncovering the sex discrimination, the double standard, the buried history of women in every single discipline as well. And it was enormous, life-affirming, life-opening. It changed life for women. It changed the way we looked at ourselves. We began to really take ourselves seriously as people and to get taken seriously as people in a new way. And there is no question that it was the most far-reaching, life-opening and life-changing movement of social change of our time and in many ways of all time, though we're just beginning to see all the ramifications. However, partly as a result of the opportunities and the new opportunities and the new necessities, not only that were articulated by the women's movement, but forced by the economic changes and the technological and lifespan evolution that brought the women's movement itself into being, partly because of the new place that women are in today, and men too, and also because we face a backlash that trying to push us back and take our rights away, I think we have come to the end of the beginning. Not the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning. We haven't by any means achieved complete equality. It is absolutely urgent that in the next 8 months we get the ERA into the Constitution, and it's going to take really a moving to second stage thinking, you know, to do that, because we have come to dead end, to impasse the way we were moving then. But what we must do in the second stage, whether or not we get the ERA, is to move on to a new set of questions to make the equality we fought for and that we must, you know, finish the job because we can't retreat from it, is to make it livable, workable, to be able to meet our own needs for love and nurture at home as well as our needs to give love and nurture to children, to men, that we must face the concrete problems of restructuring jobs of work, conditions of work, and of restructuring of home and arrangements. We must come to new terms, if you will, with the family, not retreat to old roles, but come to new terms with the family, focus on family as well as work, or we're going to leave women doubly burdened. And the second stage, these questions cannot be seen as women's questions, need not be, and cannot be seen as women's questions alone, or else they'll leave women doubly burdened, and it'll be an excuse not to hire women, but they have become men's questions as well as women.
So what specifically are the questions you're talking about?
Well, for instance, just on my way here, there was a woman who was in a studio. She was a director, floor director, or something like that. Anyway, her child was sick. So the child was homesick. So the younger child, the older child, stayed home to take care of the younger child. And the boss asked this young woman to stay late today. So she says, no way. She says, no way. And she said to me, I can't stay late. I mean, this is driving me nuts. She said, I can't stay late. Even they fire me if they, but I have to. I can't leave this child home, you know, sick any longer. Bad enough that I had to do it this long. Well, what they need is, in the union contract, they need parental sick leave. They need the ability of the parent. Just a mundane question, the ability of a parent to take his or her own sick leave when the children are sick. It should be a new condition of work for women and men, that parental sick leave. That's a second stage question, you see.
What about sharing of responsibility at the home? Is that something that you think still needs to be worked out, or do you think
I think it's being worked out. I think that it is being worked out And that, that is, again, the real trial and error, the trade-offs about that, the patterns that, by which parenting and home will be shared, that these are very much second-stage questions. I'm afraid that in the first stage, there was too much of a tendency of the woman to take it on herself. I mean, even though, you know, I mean, you see, because we weren't conscious of certain things. See, here's a woman. She's now got a job and a profession that she's, or a profession that she's lucky to have because, you know, that's economic necessity is making women work today, even ones that hadn't thought they were going to, not just the new possibilities. But the standards are set in terms of men that had wives to take care of all the details of life. Then if she's not very confident and secure yet, so she thinks she has to be more workaholic, more driven even than the man, you know. But at the same time, she's still taking it on herself too much, the responsibility for the home and the children, and too much in terms of the lives of women past, where the woman had to find her whole status, her whole identity, her whole power in the perfectly run home, perfectly controlled children, because she didn't have any control of life beyond that. All right, we have to break through. I mean, she has to break through this in her own consciousness to realize that she must and she can give up some of that excessive control and power in the home. And that she, for her to be able to work out the trade-offs with the guy, he has to obviously make some adjustments, but I think the men are beginning to make those. And they must also, because the wife, in most cases, how can they earn? How can they buy a house unless the wife is earning as well? But then, when those, even if they are, even if they work out the psychological part of it, even if he is willing to share and she is, she knows, realizes that she must give up some of the power, but not, and neither of them fall into the trap of role reversals, which I, you know, change one half life for another. I don't think that's the answer, too. I don't think house husband is the answer, although. Though, if they can afford it and they want to, why not? I don't think just a housewife is going to be the answer for many young women either, although I would like to see options like child allowances that one or other parent could stay home if he or she wished for a few years when children were little and not pay too great an economic price for that and have that work recognized equally with the wage earners and Social Security. The fact is we're not there as it is. But even if they are both willing and psychologically have worked it out in their consciousness, and I think that in this second stage we're going to have dialogue that helps our doing that, we still have to, we run up against these inflexible conditions at work and lack of child care aides in the community and at home. And so I think that we, second stage questions, and I do in my second half of the book, the second stage, I talk about take back the day, you know, and the house and the dream and questions like that, that what can we do about child care? What can we do about flexible, flex time, part-time job sharing? We won't get these things if we see them as women's questions, but they're not just women's questions anymore.
These are questions that I think people have been wrestling with for a number of years. You say now that they're not just women's questions, they're of concern to men,
right,
too.
They are newly of concern to men, young men today.
What kinds of strategies do you see now that are changing that will involve both men
and
women?
We are going to become more and more conscious of these questions, and that we're going to articulate them. And men are going to articulate them as well as women. And so we'll get out of just treating them as women's questions. That's the first thing that has to happen. The second thing is we have to see that they really, I mean, you know, instead of hypocrisy about the family, that these are the new family needs, you know, and that these are the new needs of children as well as women and men. Third, a pluralistic approach, approach that looks for many options and choices, not a single federal government solution, which when we talked about it at all in the first stage, that I think that feminists, I think that we weren't, that kind of thinking on the part of either feminists or liberals is not the answer, not only because it doesn't fit into the climate today, the political climate, to have single massive federal bureaucratic, you know, government going into the childcare business. I don't think that's the answer at all. I think parents want more control of their children's upbringing. Part of it, just as they do it in the home, some of it's now got to be done outside the home, but the parents still want to control it. I suggest in my book, The Second Stage, a voucher system you know, the same kind of voucher system that the conservatives are suggesting for perhaps more pernicious, you know, uses, but that would give parents the maximum option, and that would be done in terms of tax, a combination of tax credits and demands in union contracts, you know, of companies, you know, that an allowance, if you will, for each child that can be used if the parents want, I mean, if one parent wanted to stay home and take primary responsibility for the child care at home for a few years, or if both parents wanted to go into a flex time schedule and do it completely themselves, or if they are both returning to work, then they can use the vouchers, the tax credits or what have you, to pay for help in child care, whether it's a new profession of family child care in the home, whether it's family child care setups where another woman or man in their home, if they are good at this, then they, you know, perhaps care during the morning for or afternoon or whatever for 5 or 6 children. Nursery schools, child care centers, maybe near the nearer in the place of work, or in the neighborhood, or in the school building, which preschool and after school programs in the school building, because school buildings are not fully used anymore now that the baby boom has grown up.
You use the term the feminist mystique. What kind of, and this is, I guess, a parody almost, or a comment on the feminine mystique, which is also a term that you coined. What do you see as being the feminist mystique?
Well, I
see. Who do you think created the mystique?
Well, I think in some sense of excess reaction against the feminine mystique, it was like changing one half life for another, you know, or more subtly, if you were so afraid that if you weren't it was a new risk for women to move in the world. If you were afraid that you, also they had seen mothers and older sisters trapped, you know, in the housewife role. They'd seen it wasn't, they'd, I don't want to be trapped like my mother was, you see. So an excess reaction against it, or not trusting your own ability to really move, you know, you'd say, well, if I don't have to be independent, more independent than any man, I'll have in danger of losing it all. I'll sink back to the old excessive, you know, dependence and be at the mercy of, well, or, you know, instead of facing your own pains and vulnerabilities, you'd, you know, try to put it all on the man, make him more of an enemy than he really is, or because you had indeed seen your mother suffer. I mean, like the young women I interviewed in my book say, I'm not going to be trapped like mother was. I mean, she thought she needed was a man to take care of her, and she spent all those years being a good wife and mother and helping him build up his career, and then there was this divorce, and she was out in the cold, and she didn't have the skills or the ability to get a very good job at all, and she's in big economic trouble now, and the divorce didn't recognize her contribution at all in terms of the distribution of property, and I'm not going to be trapped like that. So then she, in excess reaction, she might look for her whole security in career, in profession. So she's in danger, if she does this too blindly, too slavishly, of locking herself into an equally confining male model, masculine mystique, a model of success in the rat race, as if that is all or could be all, that is killing men, do you see? Instead of moving to a new integration, which we must both do now, women and men, in the second stage, you know, integrating our needs for love, those same needs, nurture, love, home, that we share with the most traditional of women and with the women of time past, with the new necessities and possibilities of earning and having our own voice in career and profession, and also with the recognition that we can re-embrace our family needs in new terms, that the woman's equality in personhood as an essential bedrock of the new family changes the gestalt, and that we do, that there is a new diversity also, that we don't need to follow the same patterns at all times in our life, that there are different trade-offs, different patterns, that we've got to work these things out with men and sometimes without men.
I think there's been a constant controversy within the women's movement about whether the ultimate goal was to assimilate into the mainstream or was to change the mainstream sufficiently so that life would be changed, roles would be redefined.
Yes.
Maybe the family changed.
Well, I think
job
we have to do both.
Changed.
You see, I think we did and we do have to break into the mainstream. We did and we do have to break through the barriers of sex discrimination in employment, in education. We have to get the skills of an advanced technological society. We have to be sure that we can get the jobs to earn. We have to have our own political voice and our own voice in the churches. But by breaking in, and in breaking in, it is not just to blindly acquiesce in a set of standards that are still based on those old, unequal, polarized masculine and feminine sex roles, but there is implied a new human integration, a human restructuring, not only because women are in there, but because the whole gestalt changes. As women and men share the earning, and as men and women share the parenting, some of the qualities and experiences that have been uniquely female up to now, we'll put a new value on those in the second stage, but also those are going to be shared and valued by men more in the second stage as they, and I've got all this very, I've dealt with all this in raising some of these new questions and possibilities in my book, because these are going to be new for men, do you see? Men will be at the cutting edge here, not just women in the second stage.
Talking with Betty Friedan, if you're just joining us, in the early 70s, when NOW was first getting started and was first seeking a membership base, there was a conflict also between women in NOW and women who saw NOW as being a little too mainstream and who saw themselves as being more radical. And part of the conflict was, what are the key issues that feminism should embrace? Should there be an emphasis on the right to abortion? How much of the emphasis should be on job security or job equality, equal wages? Should lesbian rights be embraced as part of a feminist platform, or is that something that would scare a lot of people away, and that should that be left out? How has that controversy changed in the past decade? Do the questions still remain the same, do you think?
I don't think that there is. I think everybody in the women's movement really agrees that the main priority now has to be, we have to ensure equality and equal opportunity for everyone. You know, that the main priority is not, I think, well, no, I can't say everyone, because I'm sure there is a small remnant of radical feminists that probably wouldn't agree with this, and they are still locked into what I call sexual politics, or they are locked in what I call feminist reaction, if you will. But most people would agree that the main priorities have to be, first of all, this bottom line for economic survival, the ensuring of equal opportunity, and jobs, education, credit, and the like, the basic essentials, the tools, you know, for economic survival. Although I must say that in the second stage, we are looking even at these questions in new terms, not just equal pay for equal work, the good jobs that have been defined by and for men. Most women are not in those jobs, although we insist on the laws that, in fact, now are being dismantled to the machinery to break through sex discrimination. We insist on our access to those good jobs. But we also recognize the reality that most women are in jobs that have been traditionally underpaid because they are the women's job, the jobs that women have done, the service, sales, clerical, the nurse, the stewardess, and the like. And we are saying equal pay for work of comparable value, pay those jobs which are increasingly important to this society, those jobs that up to now women have done, pay them what they're really worth. What I am saying in the second stage, in my book, The Second Stage, is that we also see that it doesn't end there, even with the question of the pay and all that, that we have to address ourselves to other questions on the job in the second stage, such as flex time, not just accept the standards of given and defined in terms of the men's of lives of men that had wives to take care of the detail of life, that we have to deal with the question of flex time, maternity and paternity and parental leave, job sharing, and the like. And we also have to deal in new ways with questions having to do with family, kind of housing, childcare services, ways of sharing our resources, accepting much more completely The diversity of family. In other words, recognizing that the 90% of Americans don't live anymore in that pattern of mama the housewife, papa the breadwinner, and two children that always seem to be under six, that even where they do, the woman has new self-respect, the housewife, because of the women's movement, and she needs the equal rights amendment more than anyone, so that her work as a housewife is given equal recognition with the wage earner. But most people now are living in different kinds of patterns, at least for most of the years of their lives. They're two-paycheck families that have to be also equal opportunity parenting families, people that are where both the woman and man are struggling in a new way over the choice to have children, because it isn't a good enough choice yet when you don't have the assurance of maternity and paternity leave and childcare and the like. People that are single-parent families that have their own strengths and their own needs. People living together that are not related by blood or marriage because it is they can to meet their mutual needs for intimacy, for and for economic needs of sharing a home. Especially older people where beyond the child-rearing years, where there are enormous increase of people living alone, and most of those are women over 50 like myself. And we have new family needs, and we need new structures to meet those needs. Now, I think in the second stage, we will come to grips with all these questions, and we will not be so diverted by some of the sexual, by seeing these as sexual questions, some of them, you know, as before. Like it isn't... You know, the whole question of diversity of family and family needs of everyone and not just one conventional type of family. You know, I mean, this is the way to look at these questions.
What is it in sexual politics that you find to be diverting? I'm not sure.
Well, I
if
mean,
you could just
I just think
that.
You raised the question of the divisiveness in the women's movement over the too much preoccupation with lesbian rights. I don't think that in itself was a feminist issue. I mean, I think that it's a civil rights issue, you know, the right of people not to be harassed, you know, for sexual preference, and that feminists would be concerned with this as they are all civil rights. But that it was a sexual politics to somehow try to twist. It was a really still a reaction against the family of the past, to try to twist the sexual preference of women who happen to be lesbians into a political expression. It wasn't a political expression. It shouldn't have been, at least. It's a sexual expression. And as such, it isn't a main focus, it seems to me. It can't be a main focus of the women's movement. I mean, the political focus. The political focus has got to be on equality and making it, first of all, gaining it, And second of all, making it livable, and in the second stage, we have to focus on all of our family needs, you know.
Right, but lesbian feminists would say if you're talking about equality, and you're just focusing on the equality of heterosexual.
No, but who
feminists?
Says? But where does sex have to do with equality? In other words, I mean, do I go around talking about what I do in bed at night? What's that got to do with your need and my need for equality? We both need equality. Whether you are lesbian, whether you're heterosexual, has nothing to do with your need for equality. You need equality, and you need equal opportunity for bottom line economic survival. And then you need to make that equality livable and workable. And if you are a lesbian, your family needs are different. But you still need housing. You still need mutual supports. So you're just blurring the issue. You're making a sexual red herring. If you keep trying to exhibit your sexuality, who needs to? I mean, the question of what people do in bed at night with whom is simply not relevant. It is not relevant.
But if you're fired for doing that, it becomes
that's
relevant.
A different question.
If you're
then
not
you,
given access
if you
to
are
jobs
fired
or housing.
For doing it, then that is a civil rights issue. It is a civil rights issue. It's not because you're a woman. It's a civil rights issue. You know, it's a civil rights issue. That's all. Civil and like all civil rights issue, I mean, it seems to me feminists have to be concerned with protecting those rights. But it should never have. It blurs the other thing. It isn't relevant. It isn't relevant.
What about abortion? Where does that fit in?
Well, I mean, the right.
Do you think it's a key issue now or
of
secondary
course it's a key
issue?
Of course, it's a key issue. I mean, it's a key issue in the sense that the choice to have children is a key issue, and the choice to have children is not is essential to the personhood of a woman, the choice, that it be a choice, that it not is something forced, that has liberated the personhood of woman. It also has liberated parenting to be a really vital, joyous, and responsible choice. That means, at this point in technological development, that we must have safe, legal, medical access and education in all forms of birth control. And as a last resort, and I think we should say this quite clearly, as a last resort, safe, legal, medical access to abortion. You cannot be for abortion. How can you be? That would be like being for a mastectomy.
You'd be for the right to
abortion. You are for the right to choose.
Right.
The right to choose to have children, which, and as a last resort, safely will make access to abortion. But don't try to make abortion itself a value, because it isn't. It's no more a value than say, mastectomy. It's a last resort necessity for life, for survival, ensuring the good health of the woman. Let's not be hypocritical about it. People that claim to be for life, they are hypocritical, you see, because they seem to be only really concerned with the life of the fetus, do you see? And they are not even concerned with the life of the child, because they want to get rid of the laws that now protect children against child abuse and child beating. They don't seem to be very concerned with questions of war and peace. So they're not really for life. They also are very hypocritical on the question of abortion, because they know very well that women, when they cannot see fit to have a child, when they cannot afford to have a child, will get abortions. But if you make abortion illegal, if you make it a crime, they will get unsafe, botched up, you know, butcher type abortions that will endanger their health, their life, and their future ability to choose to have children. So those so-called pro-life forces are twisting demagogically the abortion issue, making it a big sexual red herring. And we mustn't let them do that. We are for life. We are for the right to choose to have children in the largest sense. And we are also for children and for family.
If the last resort of abortion is denied to women, then women will kind of even be kept out of second stage decisions in a way.
Oh, certainly.
I think
we absolutely must. And we must also call their hypocrisy. You see, we shouldn't use our own hypocrisy, but we must. We must not permit them to get these laws that I was in one state where there were 21 laws in the state legislature. It had been introduced in the state legislature trying to make abortion a crime. I mean, no matter what your values are on abortion, and I think that you have to respect the religious conscience of people. You're not saying that every woman, you know, should have an abortion. You're not for abortion. You are simply for the right for people to choose. But whatever your opinions on it, it isn't the main issue affecting or threatening the security of the families, the welfare of Americans today. I mean, it isn't. No matter what your views on abortion, it's being twisted all out of focus by the so-called moral majority people to take our attention away from the real economic dangers, you know. I mean, the travesty of the supply-side economics and all that sort of, what Reagan is doing to take away our ability of our families to survive.
A lot of people feel that the rights, that the battles the right is waging to take away certain rights that
right.
have been won are taking the attention away from other issues that
right.
and other battles that need to
yeah.
be fought. But that, on the other hand, while
these save the rights.
While these rights are being threatened, what do you do?
We have to save the rights.
So,
no question.
So
we have to save the rights.
What kind of strategy do you think is an appropriate strategy
abortion? For one thing, I think that we have to. I did suggest that we just change the rhetoric a little bit. No, I think that we fell into a trap with that rhetoric. I mean, I just cringe when someone says to me, well, we want to have a debate between the people who are for life and the people who are for abortion. I absolutely refuse. I am for life. I am for life. And safe, legal, medical access to abortion at this stage of the game is essential to life. But I am certainly not for abortion. You know, I mean, in other words, furthermore, I do not think that every woman, like, say, every Catholic, for instance, who happens to have in terms of his religious or her religious conscience, feels that abortion is wrong, I don't think that that person is my enemy. I feel that there's a way to work with that person. I think there's a far difference between that kind of person whose religious conscience I respect, and whose value for life and for the ability for the choice to have children and I respect. There's a far cry between that person and the dangerous demagogical preachers of the moral majority, the so-called moral majority. We must say so-called moral majority because they're not really moral, and they're not the majority either. You know the polls. You know the polls that show the great, great majority of people in America, for instance, are for the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, the Equal Rights Amendment and abortion are completely separate issues, and the far right, the so-called moral majority, is trying to twist them up together wrong. But if you get right down to it, the recent life polls show that the great, great majority of Americans, women and men, including Catholics, are for the safe, legal medical access to abortion as a last resort when it comes to the choice to have children.
Speaking with Betty Friedan, earlier we were talking about how you think that in the second stage where women have to come to terms with the decisions that you have to make and the time decisions you have to make when you're both a parent and a worker, that...
Not just women. In the second,
that's what I was coming to. You think men are going to also be on the forefront of this battle since men are sharing parenting responsibilities.
Right, and they are.
So my question is, how do you think, do you see a new movement that will be organizing men and women together to wage these battles together?
Now, there, my crystal ball, we have to move a little further in dialogue. I keep remembering that when I was writing The Feminine Mystique, when it came to do the solutions, I could only see the solutions in terms of how an individual woman would work it out, because I couldn't predict the women's movement. But after we'd had the dialogue a little bit, once we called ourselves people, once we said we're entitled to equal opportunity, then the women's movement was catalyzed into being over the question of the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and how we get it enforced to protect us against sex discrimination in employment. I think the same thing is going to happen here. I do know that these questions are already not just women's questions, that they are men's questions too, especially for the younger, the men and women. They will, I hope, and it's already happening, and my book, The Second Stage, is going to, speed this process, I'm pretty sure, even though everyone won't agree with, but it's going to speed a dialogue, bring about a dialogue, a new dialogue of women and men on questions like, how do you combine parenting and work? What changes need to be done on jobs? How are we going to get those changes? How do you work out equal opportunity parenting? What kind of new designs and housing you need? All those questions that I raise in my book, The Second Stage. Now, what the political steps are going to be? This, my crystal ball does not show me yet. In other words, will the women's movement evolve into the second stage movement? Or certainly I am not suggesting that the women's movement are organizations that have been organized basically on questions of fighting sex discrimination. They cannot, or women's caucuses in any field, they can't. I am not at all suggesting that they could even contemplate disbanding or they're needed because the job isn't done yet of fighting through sex discrimination. And certainly the priority of organizations like NOW and all the rest for the next 8 months must be absolutely to get the ERA, because without that underneath us, women can't even consider that they could use those rights and opportunities that they take for granted now and that are essential for women and men, for instance, if they hope to be able to buy houses and so on. With the laws now in the books on sex discrimination, with the machinery to enforce them being dismantled by the Reagan administration, we've got to have the ERA. The second stage questions must be raised now, whether or not we get the ERA, because the energy will not be there otherwise. The energy of the young people which are coping with these new problems, and if we don't articulate them, they're going to begin to resent, the women's movement. The energies of the women that are taking it too much on themselves now with the double burden and superwoman, and the energies of men that could be much more available to us if we change the terms, plus the energies of women that have been finding their whole identity in the family, in the home, and who need the Equal Rights Amendment as much as anyone. We also, whether or not we get the ERA, we are going to have to move on to these other questions and not just as women's questions. Will that happen as an evolution of the women's movement in coalition with labor unions or others? Or will there be a whole new movement of women and men? Of this, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the dialogue itself will determine this, or concrete issues such as childcare, such as flex time, which I think will begin to have real cogency and urgency with the labor unions, if the labor unions want to have real vitality for the second stage.